story. The Pentagon says its airstrikes on Iraq and Syria border targeted arms depots it alleges belong to anti-U.S. militia. Syrian media reported deadly attacks hit a residential area. Yemeni army says it has hit Saudi Arabia's military positions in Najran, Abha, and Khamis Mushayt in a retaliatory ballistic missile and drone attack. Also ahead, partial results show the centrist party of French President Macron and far-right national rally of Marine Le Pen have suffered defeat in the regional elections runoff. My name is Oray Zahedi. Welcome. The Pentagon says the U.S. military has carried out airstrikes on Iraq-Syria border targeting positions belonging to anti-U.S. militia. It added that the strikes targeted operational and weapons storage facilities at two locations in Syria and one in Iraq. Our correspondent, Muhammad Ali, tells us more.
So according to Syrian state media, at about 1 a.m. Local time here in Syria, fighter jets believed to be American attacked residential apartments near a town called Al Bukamal, which is on the borderline between Syria and Iraq. Now, the attack, according to Sana, officially the state media over here, state news agency, the attack killed one child and injured three other civilians, as well as it caused material damage to those apartments, residential areas over there near Al Bukamal. This is according to Syrian state media. There is still no official statement by any official here in Syria yet. We also know that the U.S. claimed responsibility for the attack in a statement released by the Pentagon, which said that at President Biden's direction, U.S. military forces conducted precision airstrikes in Syria and Iraq, two strikes in Syria and one in Iraq.
Author and activist Eve Engler earlier told me the U.S. has no right whatsoever to kill people in Syria under the pretext of self-defense.
The U.S. has no right to be killing and bombing people in Syria. And if it's going to do that, it certainly shouldn't be justifying that as defense. So, yes, obviously, if there was a child killed, which some reports are suggesting, that's obviously terrible. And it just adds to a long list of children, civilians, women who have been killed by the U.S. in Syria, in Iraq, and in so many different countries. I think that the U.S. has at times clearly supported ISIS and has, you know, enabled them to grow. And I don't think that the U.S.'s primary objective right now is definitely not about ISIS. It's about controlling the region, and it's, I think, a bit of a competition or geopolitical battle with Iran. It's about weakening Assad. It's about controlling oil. I mean, in Syria, I mean, American troops, about 1,000 U.S. troops are still just controlling, and this is explicit. They're not even hiding it. We're just keeping control of Syrian oil.
The Yemeni army says it has launched a major missile and drone attack against sensitive military targets in Saudi Arabia's southern region. Army spokesman Yahya Sari said the country's missile force and air force carried out the joint operation using five ballistic missiles and as many drones. He said the strikes hit a National Guard compound in the city of Najran, military positions in Abha International Airport and King Khalid Air Base in the city of Khamis Mushayt. Seri added that missiles and drones hit the designated targets with precision. Yemen's army carries out such retaliatory attacks against Saudi Arabia in response to a deadly war waged by Riyadh on its Arab neighbor. Yemen has once again slammed the United Nations for what it calls the double standard regarding the crimes committed by the Saudi-led coalition against Yemeni children. Abdul Latif al-Washali reports.
Children and Armed Conflict in Yemen 2021 was the title of the recent report of the Secretary General of the United Nations. In a press conference held by Yemen's Ministry of Human Rights, Yemen government discussed the UN report and how children protection could be achieved.
For years now, we have been used to see the United Nations doing the opposite of what it should do regarding the crimes of the Saudi-led coalition. This report in itself is considered a war crime against the children of Yemen. It was clear from the first day of the war in Yemen that the United Nations seeks to legitimize war and crimes.
The ministry said the report of the United Nations is full of inaccuracies and doesn't rely on any investigation on the ground, adding that the report aims to legitimize the Saudi war crimes against Yemeni children.
The most serious inaccuracy in the recent United Nations report is that it zeroed the number of crimes committed by the Saudi-led coalition countries and did not mention any of their crimes. Unfortunately, the United Nations accused the Yemeni army of targeting more than 7,000 children, and these numbers are incorrect. The United Nations didn't explain where it has got these statistics from.
Saudi Arabia, backed by Washington, launched a devastating war on Yemen in March 2015. During the war years, Riyadh has committed numerous violations of international law, including using internationally prohibited weapons in its air raids, which have killed tens of thousands of civilians, most of them women and children.
Besides the ongoing Saudi siege that prevents millions of Yemenis, including children, from getting food, medicine and fuel, Saudi airstrikes have also killed more than 4,000 Yemeni children alone, according to rights organizations. Abdul Latif Al-Washali, Sana.
A report showed the United Kingdom has sold weapons to nations found guilty of human rights abuses. We discussed that matter with our guests in our news review program.
Britain, between 2011 and 2020, sold more than $23 billion of weapons to countries listed among states with dire human rights records. That's what new analyses show. 21 countries which purchased weapons from London were on the UK's own list of repressive regimes. That's what one analysis by the London-based Campaign Against Arms Trade shows. Another analysis was conducted by the UK government's Department for International Trade. It identified nine nations guilty of human rights abuses as the core markets for UK arms exports. It said these states included Bahrain and Saudi Arabia. London has previously admitted that Saudi Arabia and its allies used British-made weapons in their war on Yemen. The war has killed tens of thousands of Yemenis since it began in 2015. Joining us is Zafara Bengesh, the director at the Institute of Contemporary Islamic Thought from Toronto, and we also have Brian Terrell, political commentator and peace activist, joining us out of Malloy. Gentlemen, welcome. Zafar, the British government is well aware of that its weapons are being used in Saudi Arabia, in Saudi Arabia's war on Yemen, and is also well aware that its weapons are being used in Bahrain's deadly crackdown on the revolution in the kingdom in Bahrain. So, Savar, why would the UK sell weapons to these dictatorships?
Well, basically, Saudi Arabia is a client state, both of Britain and more particularly of the United States, but arms trade is a very lucrative trade, and Britain has a very, very long history of supplying weapons to the Saudi regime. You mentioned these figures from 2011 to 2020. Of course, Saudi Arabia is the largest importer of weapons in the world today. And of course, it's using those weapons against the people of Yemen. And a number of people in Britain actually have lodged court cases against the British government. And the High Court in Britain put a stop to it or a halt on it until this was investigated. But unfortunately, the British government continues to supply weapons to the Saudi regime despite the Saudi's atrocious human rights record, both in Yemen, in Bahrain, as well as internally inside Saudi Arabia. There are a lot of human rights violations going on. Dissidents are either thrown in jail or executed. A couple of weeks ago, there were several people that were executed. So in other words, Britain and Western countries in general, unfortunately, do not care about human rights. They simply use those as propaganda
for propaganda purposes, but they continue to sell weapons to these atrocious regimes because there's a lot of money to be made from weapon sales.
Right, interesting. Brian, I mean, when you see British-made weapons being dropped on Yemen and killing Yemeni children, one has to ask, is the blood of a British child more valuable than the blood of a Yemeni child?
Well, I think that question goes to, you know, it's not the versus the Yemeni child versus the British child, because this is hurting everyone. This is Britain is facing huge challenges economically and socially, and these are resources that could be used otherwise. But as our friend said, this is very lucrative. I think the point of U.S. and U.K. weapons manufacturing is not to support human rights, as they sometimes claim. And we are fighting wars now. The wars the U.S. and U.K. is fighting in Afghanistan now is going on 20 years. And we see the fruition of what the British writer George Orwell warned about, and the former President of the United States, President Eisenhower, warned about, a military-industrial complex in which we have wars that are not intended to be won or to be resolved in any way. And the fact that the weapons that we sell and that we that the United States and UK uses itself, that the fact that it only increases the terrorism we talk about, it only increases the wars and makes the wars worse, is actually seen as a very, very positive thing. Back in February, when President Biden threatened to cut off military aid to Saudi Arabia for the war in Yemen, the CEO of Raytheon Technologies, Greg Hayes, reassured the investors. He said, look, peace is not going to break out in the Middle East anytime soon. I think it remains, that this will remain to be a place that continues to see solid growth. So we look at this war in Yemen, and it seems intractable, and it's the millions of people are in danger of famine due to the war and blockade. And to the industrialists, to the investors behind this, peace breaking out is their greatest fear. And they are reassuring themselves that the Middle East will remain a place of growth. They, we can keep selling these weapons. As long as we can sell the weapons, we can sell more weapons. This will not be resolved. It's a cycle meant to be perpetuated.
Gentlemen, thank you. I'm afraid we have run out of time. I'm going to have to end it there. Let me thank our guest, Savar Bangesh, director at the Institute of Contemporary Islamic Thought, joining us out of Toronto, and Brian Terrell, political commentator and peace activist, joining us out of Malloy. And that brings an end to our this segment of the News Review.
Welcome back. In France, partial results show that the centrist ruling party of President Emmanuel Macron and his far-right rivals have both suffered defeat in the regional elections runoff. Macron's party could not even break into double figures nationwide. A far-right party of National Rally, headed by Marine Le Pen, failed to win power in any of France's 13 regions. By contrast, traditional parties, namely the right-wing party of the Republicans as well as the Socialist Party, performed well in the vote. The turnout was estimated to be 34%. Sunday's runoff was held after last week's first round did not see any parties win over 50%. Regional elections come ahead of next year's presidential vote. Russian capital has registered its highest daily number of COVID-19 fatalities since the pandemic began. Official figures show that 144 people died of coronavirus in Moscow in the past 24 hours. That is also the worst daily death toll so far posted for a Russian city. The country has seen an explosion of new infections since mid-June. The surge is mainly due to the Delta variant that was first identified in India. The variant is also feeding fresh outbreaks in Southeast Asia and Australia, prompting authorities to bring back or prolong restrictions. The World Health Organization says the Delta variant has now been confirmed that is in 85 countries. The organization says it is the most contagious of any COVID-19 strain identified. Now, South Africa has announced it'll tighten COVID-19 restrictions for 14 days to stem a sharp rise in infections. Authorities highlighted that additional restrictions are necessary as current containment measures are not enough to prevent a surge in the number of cases. Under the measures announced, all gatherings will be prohibited and there will be a curfew from 9 p.m. to 4 a.m. The wave of COVID-19 infections in the country has been driven by the spread of the more transmissible Delta variant, weak countermeasures, and public fatigue with existing restrictions. The overall caseload in South Africa has surpassed the 1.9 million mark. Total fatalities from the virus hover around 60,000. Journalist and commentator Julio Sembaluto says several factors have contributed to the surge in COVID-19 infections in South Africa.
That's a combination of different factors. Of course, you have the Delta variant, which is a key thing, which they are trying to control the spread. But also you have the situation they are in the world. We are talking about South Africa being part of African countries where supply of jobs hasn't happened. We saw during G7 meeting in Europe, promises made through COVAX, which is a facility for World Health Organization to supply, you know, COVID pandemic jobs into Africa. That is not happening as well. And therefore, with no promise of jobs coming on the ground, because the mechanism doesn't seem to be working, the global mechanism, and also with also the rising numbers, I think South Africa is doing the right thing to take measures to control the spread. And of course, we attribute this to the latest Delta variant, and in South Africa and many countries in Africa now, it's the third wave.
The death toll from a 12-story building collapse in the U.S. city of Surfside, Florida, has risen to 9. Search and rescue operations are underway for more than 150 others who are still missing. 3 days after the incident, crews are yet to find any sign of life. The building was built in 1981 and was undergoing a recertification process requiring repairs. A 2018 report by a consultant engineer had warned about major structural damage to the building. Residential complex had more than 130 units, some 80 of which were occupied. Miami-Dade County officials said all buildings more than 40 years old will be audited to ensure their safety. Extreme weather conditions news, an explosion that has happened and has ripped the Bangladeshi capital of Dhaka, leaving at least 7 dead and dozens more injured. The blast hit a 3-story building in central Dhaka on Sunday. Police said the explosion was so forceful that broke the windows of nearby moving buses and damaged the surrounding buildings. Officials cited a gas pipeline as the likely cause of the blast, but said they will carry out more investigations into the incident. The Bangladeshi capital has witnessed several similar explosions in recent years. And that's it with international news.
A diverse range of programs. Youth. Spirituality. Culture. Eastern Tales. Roundtable discussions. Politics. All produced by IRIB English Radio.
Our website is www.parstoday.com/en.
In the limelight.
Peace and human rights advocates joined the United Nations General Assembly in their annual condemnation of the United States' disastrous economic embargo against Cuba. Critics this year noted the detrimental effects of the embargo on Cuba's ability to combat the COVID-19 pandemic. In this regard, we have prepared an article for you written by Brett Wilkins Ryder. This article is published under the heading, Only U.S. and Israeli Regime Vote Against Resolution Demanding End to Blockade of Cuba. Stay tuned for more. Peace and human rights advocates joined the United Nations General Assembly recently in their annual condemnation of the United States' disastrous economic embargo against Cuba. For the 29th straight year, the members of the General Assembly voted overwhelmingly in favor of a resolution demanding an end to the 60-year U.S. economic blockade on Cuba. This year, 184 nations voted in favor of the resolution, while the United States and the Zionist regime voted against it. Three nations, including Brazil, Colombia, and Ukraine, abstained. Critics this year noted the detrimental effects of the embargo on Cuba's ability to combat the COVID-19 pandemic. Cuban Foreign Minister Bruno Rodriguez Padilla slammed the blockade as a massive, flagrant, and unacceptable violation of the human rights of the Cuban people and an economic war of extraterritorial scope against a small county already affected in the recent period by the economic crisis derived from the pandemic. Like the virus, the blockade suffocates and kills and must end, Rodriguez told the General Assembly. Cuba said earlier this month that the decades-old U.S. trade embargo cost it a record total of more than $9 billion over the last financial year, hurting its ability to tackle the coronavirus pandemic. Foreign Minister Rodriguez told the General Assembly that sanctions had made it harder for Cuba to acquire medical equipment needed to develop its own COVID-19 vaccines and for other uses, as well as equipment for food production. Spain's UN delegation said that the U.S. embargo against Cuba has a detrimental impact on the country's economic situation and negatively affects the standard of living of the Cuban people. Indonesia's UN mission asserted that the blockade violates norms and principles of international law and sovereign equality of states and hinders Cuba's recovery from the COVID-19 pandemic. Sofiane Mimouni, Algeria's ambassador to the UN, reaffirmed his country's unwavering solidarity with the government and brotherly people of Cuba, as well as its support for the lifting of the long-standing and unnecessary embargo imposed on Cuba. Mexico's UN mission said it reiterates its condemnation of the economic, commercial, and financial blockade against Cuba and calls for its end. Rodney Hunter, political coordinator for the U.S. mission to the UN, countered that sanctions are one set of tools in Washington's broader effort toward Cuba to advance democracy, promote respect for human rights, and help the Cuban people exercise fundamental freedoms. Although the Obama administration took steps to normalize relations with Cuba, the past 60 years have been characterized by varying degrees of U.S. hostility toward the socialist government and, by extension, the Cuban people. Having lost effective economic control of the island in 1959, Following the successful socialist revolution led by Fidel Castro, successive U.S. administrations waged a decades-long campaign of state-sanctioned exile terror, attempt subversion, failed assassination attempts, economic warfare, and covert operations, large and small, in a fruitless policy of regime change. There have been 13 U.S. administrations since the triumph of the Cuban Revolution. According to the Cuban government, U.S.-backed terrorism has claimed nearly 3,500 lives and cost the island's economy at least hundreds of billions of dollars.
Food for thought.
Hello, dear friends. For your information, when a person asks Imam Ali ibn Musa al-Reza, peace be upon him, as to who are the best servants of God, the Holy Prophet's eighth infallible heir replied, "Those persons who, when they perform a good deed, become glad. When they commit a bad deed, they ask the forgiveness of Allah. When they are granted, they thank for it. When they are afflicted and grieved, they exercise patience. And when they get angry, they forgive the faults of others."
Is there any other way to get familiar with Islam besides mainstream media? Try IRIB English Radio.
Log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
This man changed the world.
Allahu Akbar, Khomeini Rahbar. Allahu Akbar, Khomeini Rahbar.
Our bosses couldn't cope with the idea of an 80-year-old Ayatollah, which they didn't even know what an Ayatollah was, who lived on garlic and onions and yogurt, directing a revolution that was about to topple America's most important ally.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim, in the name of Allah, the Exalted, the Most Compassionate, the Most Merciful. Salam, hello and welcome to our audience, and particularly a warm welcome to our program, The Man Who Changed the World. This program is about the life and times of Imam Khomeini, may God bless his great soul. And in today's program, we're going to begin it by listening to a quote from the Supreme Leader, Sayyid Ali Khamenei, who's going to say a few things about this great personality.
Agar izzat, izzat nafs, dar darun layahay amiq wujood insan nufuz kard.
If self-respect permeates the deepest layers of one's being, one will not be affected by Satan. One will not be affected by human passions. One will not become a slave to lust and wrath. And Imam Khomeini was such a person.
Imam dar tool hayat, che dar hawzeye ilm o tadris.
Throughout his studying and teaching years, throughout the time he was engaged in political activities, and throughout the time he was managing the country, Imam Khomeini remained in manifestation of, quote, rely on the mighty, the merciful. The Holy Quran, chapter 26, verse 217.
برای همین بود که کارهای بزرگ که همه میگفتند نشدنی است.
It was for this reason that he managed to do what was considered impossible. All the obstacles which were considered insurmountable became surmountable after he stepped into the arena. Not only was Imam Khomeini the embodiment of honor and spiritual power, but he also revived the spirit of honor among our people. This was the great achievement that our magnanimous Imam accomplished.
روح عزت را در ملت هم زنده کرد. این کار بزرگ امام بزرگوار بود. ملت ما با احساس عزتی که از درس‌های انقلاب و امام آموخت.
Our nation rediscovered itself by relying on the sense of honor that it gained from Imam Khomeini and the revolution. Our nation discovered itself and its capabilities. And this is the reason why we have seen many of the divine promises being fulfilled in front of our eyes over the past few decades. We have seen with our own eyes the kind of things that we would only read about in history books. Over these years, we have seen the arrogant powers being defeated by the oppressed. We have seen that the seemingly impressive castles of the arrogant powers are built on air. We have seen many such
things.
Once again, very powerful description of how he viewed the great Imam. And he mentions the fact that, of course, the Imam, as you mentioned in previous programs, Dr. Mahdi Turabi, first of all, I'd like to say salam to you and welcome to you to the program.
Alaykum salam rahmatullah. Thank you for having me.
He mentions the fact that, of course, Imam Khomeini came to help the oppressed. He came to raise those people who were oppressed, to give them confidence to stand and make their stand against the tyrants of our time. And, of course, we're going to speak about some major events that took place at the outset of the Islamic Revolution here in Iran, because there was so much going on, there's so much to speak about, and there were so many great events which really, both in the East as well as the West, we were completely taken aback by. We were sometimes quite shocked by what was happening. But again, the Supreme Leader makes it very clear that the way he views the Imam as a pure personality who really
challenge the Satan of our time. So, Dr. Mahdi Tarabi, can you take us to the next level, if I can put it that way, in terms of, what the Supreme Leader had to say about this great personality?
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. I think what we heard from the Supreme Leader, and by the way, what we heard in those few sentences was the Supreme Leader speaking at the anniversary of the death of Imam Khomeini,
right,
which
right.
is held every
that's
year.
That's very important. Yes, of
at
course.
The shrine. Of Imam Khomeini. That,
so this is the context in which
right.
we heard this
quote.
And
in that annual event, you have the Supreme Leader coming and talking about Imam and the revolution, and it's actually one of the important events of the calendar in the Islamic Republic, and. As he said, we saw these things with our own eyes. We witnessed these things. We experienced these things. And he said that, when somebody has complete trust in Allah, then, shaitan, the devil, iblis, whatever you want to call it, that inner, that self which, leads you to the wrong things, does not control you any longer. You are not swayed by threats. You are not deceived
by offers. Yes.
You don't let your anger and your desires, get in the way of what needs to be done and the way you need to act and behave properly. So this is what the Supreme Leader talks about when he's talking about Imam. And he talked about the fact that this was the case at the time when Imam was a seminary teacher, this was the case before the revolution when he was leading the revolutionary movement, and this was the case after the victory of the Islamic revolution and where he was the leader, the supreme leader, and the imam of this revolution and the Islamic Republic. And remember, each of these stages has its own tricks and its own deceptions and its own
traps. Yes.
And in each stage you had a man from the beginning
who's firm,
who worked on himself at a young age. And remember, Imam always used to tell us, he used to say, you work on yourself when you're young. Gain control of yourself when you're young. It's very difficult when you get older.
That's true.
And, we even have this in Islamic irfan. We have it in Islamic, the
teachings, yes.
The teachings, the ethics teachings that, when you reach 40, things are rooted.
Your
behaviors become rooted in your personality.
Exactly.
Not that it's impossible, but becomes more difficult. These behaviors then have, established roots, and it becomes more difficult to rip them out. And those good behaviors that you have, in the same way, you have rooted them; they have become part of your personality. But after 40, and 40 is one of those magical
years.
We have this in many religions. We even have it in Judaism. We have it, in different.
Yes. Absolutely.
In different traditions where the age of 40 is one of those. We have it in the Quran. Where you reach 40, you thank God for the parents that you had. And
that's right. Yes, absolutely.
You yourself have become a parent and you realize many things. So Imam used to tell everyone that, work on yourself when you're young. So he did this for himself. He was known before he was known as a faqih, before he was known as a legal scholar. At the time when he was younger and teaching in the Hawza, he was known as the teacher of philosophy and of ethics, and this is what he did. So when these challenges then happened in his life, he was able to
withstand them
and to respond to them in the way that pleases Allah.
Exactly, which pleases Allah. That's a very, very important point.
When he was given worldly power, he did not abuse it.
No, he did not.
He did not lose himself. He did not do things that would make us ashamed.
Let me put it in
make himself ashamed.
Exactly.
We've talked about many times.
Yeah, just in a conventional sense.
We've talked many times about people going to Jamaran, visiting his residence, so to speak.
I've seen
and,
it,
we say residence with a little smile.
Smile, yes.
It's quote-unquote residence. It's a 60-meter apartment.
Apartment. It's very small.
Which 60 square meters, which is where Imam and his wife lived at the time when he was the leader of the Islamic Republic.
Well, that's what I'm saying. Because I was going to say that in the conventional sense...
Two rooms.
That you have these charismatic leaders or, even in a positive sense, if I want to put it that way. But of course, when you look at their residence, when you look at the the salary they get, receive, the benefits and the privileges of their position. You know, Imam Khomeini had none of that. And that was the first thing that threw us when we first encountered this gentleman at the time of the, you know, this leader at the revolution, that we began to understand that he was a man who never gave a damn for palaces, for, you know, extraordinary residencies. And, you know, I mean, I've seen the place myself. I went there and, you know, there's a plaque outside the door which says that this was rented.
Yeah, it was rented.
Rented. I mean, that's the thing. It's rented to a leader. I mean, a country that is rich in oil wealth.
Think about this for a second.
Yeah.
You are you are the leader of a revolution.
Sure.
People, you know, sacrificing themselves for you.
Exactly.
He insists on renting this place and paying it with his own money.
With his own money. And it's, you know...
Not... And he says, you know, I'm not going to take money from the state coffers. I'm not going to take it. I'm not going to have the budget. No. There was no such thing as the budget of the supreme leader or of the imam, you know, in as part of the government budget. You know what I mean?
No, it's extraordinary. It makes me very emotional at this moment.
He comes from a family from Khomeini. They had properties there, land properties, which they had rented or which the... they would have an income from the agricultural products that were produced on there. And this is how he made his money. That's it. And he used to talk about it, or not he himself, but his relatives mentioned a few times that this was family property. It wasn't just his. It was, you know, among a group of the descendants of the original owners, you know, cousins and so on.
Sure.
And they used to pool this money, and some of the money they would use to feed the poor people in the in their family. You know what I mean? They would, you know.
Yes.
The money would come in yearly, then they would distribute it. They'd be like, okay, who's poor in the family? Who recently had a baby? Who, you know, who needs the money right now? Who wants to get married? Blah, blah, blah. You know, all these things that families usually discuss.
Yes.
And so they would use that. And then he would get his share, okay, as part of the family. And then he would use it to pay his rent in his 60 meters. His 60 square meters, and he's the supreme leader. Okay, remember, this was not this was because of Imam Ali alayhi salam.
Exactly. This is because
he's the follower of the Prophet, peace be upon him. He's the follower of the Prophet, peace be upon him. He's the follower of Imam Ali alayhi salam, and this is the way they lived. This is the way they taught us to live. That even if you're at the height of power, and people are completely devoted to you, you will not lose yourself. Okay, and this is a problem we have.
It is very much so, and
this is even Muslims. We're not even talking about.
Yeah, I know.
You know, we're not accepting ourselves
right
from
across
this.
The board.
Okay, we lose ourselves instead of becoming more humble. The more Allah blesses us, the more arrogant we become, as you said. Yeah. The more arrogant we become. Okay, instead of the opposite, which is the more Allah blesses you, the more humble you have to become, the more careful you have to become, the more you have to. You know, think about every breath you're taking, everything you're saying, every move and every action that you have. You have to start thinking about that more, because you have more responsibility, because you have a higher goal, a higher aim. And when Allah blesses you, you know, this is how you move up. Allah sees that you have the capability, so He gives you more. If Allah sees you don't have the capability, that's it. It's done. It's finished. This is the level you reached. Good for you. Mm-hmm. Inshallah, you'll go to heaven. Inshallah, things will be good. But this is your capacity. Now, look at a person like Imam. And again, we are saying all this while remembering that, you know, Imam is just a small, you know, reflection of the greatness of the Prophet, peace be upon him, and the Imams. If a fallible human being, like me and you. If a nice old Sayyid like Imam was, you know, lovable and can do this and is like this and you've seen it, imagine the Prophet, peace be upon him.
The Prophet of Mercy, yes.
Imagine Imam Ali alayhi salam. Imagine the other Imams. And think about the things they were done to them. Think about the way they were treated by this world and those people around them. Okay? We saw the Imam. We saw what is possible for a human being who attaches himself to God. We saw it. We can't, you know, it's hard for us to repeat it, but we saw it.
We saw it.
We can't, like we said in the previous programs, we can't go back to the way we were before.
No, we can't.
You know, we can't, when we stand in front of Allah, you know, we can't say to him, well, we didn't know. He says, you knew. You yeah. saw it.
Yes.
You were there.
Yeah.
He was there with you. Okay?
Sure.
So, remember, all this is of a person who is fallible. Of a person like me and you.
Yes.
Not like the prophets the imams who are designed, created to lead
and selected. Yeah.
This is a man who worked on himself as a young person, who killed his nafs early on, and like the supreme leader says, was then immunized to all these things that happened later, whether it was being a teacher, like the incident that we spoke about in the previous program. So here is a man. He's a teacher in the Qom Seminary. It's the height of the Shah's power. Everybody trying to, you know, even for the sake of survival or with the excuse of, well, we're trying to just save Islam, trying to get on the good side of the Shah so that maybe they will get a favor. And I'm talking, this is normal behavior among humanity.
That's true. Yes.
You think to yourself, well, you know, this person's powerful. Maybe if I can convince him, you know, this, that, whatever. You start making your calculations. So here's a man at the height of the Shah's power. The Shah is coming to visit the seminary, and he doesn't get up for him. Everybody else gets up for him, for the Shah to, you know, show their quote-unquote respect.
As I want to mention for our audience, you know, that we cannot forget the ferocity and the barbarity with which the Shah dealt with his opponents.
Well, you know, this is when the Supreme Leader says that he was like this. Before even, he was like this when he was our teacher in the seminary. Mm. Well, this is what, you know, Imam didn't change.
No, he didn't change.
Imam was always Imam.
Imam, yeah.
Okay?
Yeah.
He changed people around him. This is what prophets do. This is what the Imams do. This is what what the men and women of God do.
Yeah.
They change the people around
them.
They don't let the outside influence them. They influence everybody else.
Yeah.
This is the goal.
This is the goal.
Yes. Very hard to achieve because it takes the scariest thing is dealing with yourself. The scariest thing is challenging your own nafs.
Yes, confronting oneself, yes.
Your own ego and your own, you know,
arrogance
and your own animal instincts. That's the hardest thing to do.
That's right.
This is why we have in many spiritual traditions talking about, you know, the Chinese have this, the Indians have this,
yes.
Where they say, you know, the one who has conquered himself is the greatest conqueror.
Is the greatest conqueror.
The That's one who is able to control himself has the greatest control. So this is the point. You have, throughout history, you know, many leaders, political leaders, who went out and, you know, took over half the world, but they are nothing. In the sight of God, they're nothing. They're worse. They're animal. They're worse than the worst animal.
Animals.
Because at least animals have an instinct, and they don't go against that instinct. They don't.
Yeah.
We had, you know, there was a very famous cleric in Iran before the revolution, and he died shortly after the revolution, a few years after the revolution, Allama Ja'fari. Mm. He's famous for it. And he used to talk about this fact that, you know, once a lion kills his prey and eats, he then relaxes. He sits down, and even if other animals come, he lets them eat of it, you know.
Yes, quite.
And he says, but humans are not like this. Once they kill their prey, they stand up and they beat their chest and say, look, I killed him, don't come close, you know.
Mm.
He says, this is the difference between animals and humans. Humans can be the worst of the worst, which is all what the Quran talks about, you know, that they're worse than cattle.
Mm.
That they're worse than animals, some humans, when they go to the lowest.
Well, I mean, since you've raised the point about the cattle, we might as well, you know, quote from those who were opposed to the imam, who, you know...
Right.
Yeah.
Exactly.
Because now we're going to talk about, you know, quoting from a newspaper,
right.
The Times, and this is from London, and of course the media was, particularly the Western media, was very, very vile sometimes, even in terms of Imam Khomeini and what was happening in Iran. But I think this quote is slightly different, but it comes from a Zionist-backed
paper in the UK. It's a long quote, again.
Yeah, from the Rupert Murdoch era.
Right.
Yeah.
I mean, I'm just going to give the summary of it.
Yeah,
and
please.
Remember, so here is what the Supreme Leader said about, and we talked about this in the previous program, where, you know, Imam was able to really mobilize
human beings.
Mobilize them,
as
yes.
As human beings, to yes. their full potential, yes. giving dignity, telling them that you could do this.
Mm.
That your faith is that thing that, you know, determines whether Allah is with you or not.
Not
other things.
Sure.
Which, again, we have to remind the people who weren't there at that time, you know, what kind of a world we lived in. It was very elitist. It was very Western-centric.
Mm.
It was very much you had to be this kind of Western, secular, you know, type person to be considered even, you know, worthy of talking to. You know, everybody else was just the scum of the earth.
Yeah. Yeah.
Okay, so this is from the Times, and again, I'm just paraphrasing. I'm not giving the direct quote. He talks, and this is the Times. As you mentioned, everybody who is in Britain knows the...
Yeah.
You know, the Times is
this is an elitist, conservative broadsheet.
Exactly. They say Imam Khomeini was a person who was able to mobilize the people and enchanted them with his words. You know, he spoke the language of the people, of the normal people. Of course, you know, this is, you know, you remember who's saying this. You know,
yes.
he's speaking the language of the peasants, not us, you know, Queen's English.
Yes, exactly. Yes.
And his followers were the poor and oppressed and deprived. Oh. Now, hey, remember
we
talked about, you know, who were the followers of the prophets?
Prophet
Muhammad, peace be upon him.
Exactly.
It was the poor and the slaves.
Yes.
It was the deprived. So maybe for them, this is considered a negative thing, but, you know, for God, this is what the prophets used to do.
Exactly.
And it continues, it says that he gave them self-confidence, the people, the mm-hmm. poor, the deprived.
Mm-hmm.
And he gave them the feeling and the sentiment, the idea that they were able to put aside and confront anything that stands in their way. This is what we're talking about. Remember,
yes.
we talked about this.
They're moving mountains here.
Right. That anybody mm. who stands in their way, they can be put aside. And he gave them the... he inspired them.
Inspired them.
That they could even, and they say even, that they could even stand up to great powers like America and not be scared.
This is the Times from London.
Right.
Even they are compelled to write in this manner.
They are compelled. They have to admit it.
They have to admit it.
Right. Mm. Not gladly.
Not gladly.
With, you know,
with
that...
great reluctance,
with
I'm
with
sure.
that little, you know, mm. acid, you know, tongue...
Tongue, yes,
with
of
that
course.
Little, with that little, mm. you know, because sour note in
yeah,
it.
Yeah, because as I remind my audience, this paper was very, you know, anti, you know, what was happening with the revolution here in Iran. So that's one hell of a quote from them. Yeah.
Say, so again, we see that even the enemies mm. had to acknowledge.
Even the enemies had to acknowledge.
Had to acknowledge Imam. Mm. And even I would argue the thing that we quoted from Kissinger, you know, in the previous program.
That's right.
I would argue that that wasn't... I think there was a tone of admiration in there somewhere.
Yes, yes.
You know,
I mean,
think
this was another thing.
You
yes.
know, I think there was a point mm. where mm. even somebody like Kissinger, you know, the grand strategist and, you know,
yes.
holding all the different, mm-hmm. you know, magic balls, you know, juggling
these all the various.
And he's yeah. looking at Imam, he's like, I don't know, I can't figure it out. Who is this man, you know? He did things that shook us.
Yes.
Okay?
Yes.
He made decisions that we didn't know what to do about. Mm. So I'm not saying admiration in the, you know, in the real sense, but he
but
acknowledges.
There was an acknowledgement that what's the words we are looking for here? It's like
it was real.
It was real.
It wasn't just one of those. You know, they met. You know, the challenge has been met.
That challenge has been met.
Right.
Yes,
and
yes.
here, the Times. It's interesting because remember, again, we're talking about the Times within the context of British society.
An admirable challenger, if you like. Yes.
Okay. You have somebody. You have a newspaper like the Times, which is a complete, you know, elitist.
Yes.
You know, from beginning to end.
Yes.
Completely steeped in that, you know, class structure and in that aristocratic culture.
That's right, backed by Rupert Murdoch's
right.
money.
I mean, just completely, you know, looking down on the peasants, even in Britain, and
yes.
like you say, you know, what
you
are
know,
these
the
crazy
working
Scots?
Class have no...
Right.
Yeah.
You know, and their whole thing is, well, he gave the poor people...
this is a cardinal sin as
right.
far as
I mean, how dare
concerned.
You? How dare you? You
how
know,
dare you raise
how,
the
how dare
peasants
you
against us?
Right.
Yeah.
So, you know, this is why they're so...
Well, I mean, it comes back to
again,
the
again, we have
it,
to remember, this is what the prophets did.
Did, yes.
Okay.
I mean, this is why, you know, it comes back to me in the 80s. You know, I mean, I was at almost finishing high school at that time. But, you know, it comes back to me that, you know, what an iconic image he was. I mean, really, I mean, in spite of all the vitriol propaganda that was, you know, being putered out of the Western media, in spite of that, he was such an iconic image. I mean, he was on every broadsheet. He was on every headline. I mean, Time magazine, you name it. I mean, he was on, you know, he was 24 hours a day on our news bulletins. I mean, it was extraordinary. We were just sitting there on the edge of our seats wondering what the Ayatollah is going to do next.
Right. And it's interesting you mention this because many of the Western journalists who, you know, interviewed him or witnessed the events, many of them were moved.
I mean, they couldn't interview him. I mean, this was the thing. I mean, they were professionals who couldn't.
Right.
You know.
So this was something that, you know, people, like we said, you know, all these things that we're talking about, this was experiences. This wasn't theoretical. This wasn't propaganda.
No.
People who had nothing to do with Islam, with the Islamic Republic, Iran, with religion, with religion.
With religion. Full stop. Yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
You know, these people couldn't help but be affected by this man. Okay. So this is the point we're making here, that, you know, God sends his his messengers.
He sends his
messengers. God's message is established. There's no denying it. Mm. You can kick and scream and fight. You're not going
to
win
anything
against God.
Yeah.
Okay?
Yeah.
And when it's necessary, God suddenly brings someone and it shakes the world. It it completely changes the way things are done.
The
Again,
whole dynamic,
I repeat.
Yeah.
As we spoke about in different in the previous programs, you know, if you look at the Islamic world, there's pre Imam Khomeini, there's post Imam Khomeini.
Yes.
You know, if you look at the Ummah.
If you look at the Ummah.
I mean, it affected everyone. Those who hated Ahlul Bayt, and those like the Takfiris and the Wahhabis, whose izzat is being connected to the Zionists and the Americans, they got more angry.
Yes.
They got more vicious.
Vicious.
They got more, you know, nasty.
Mm.
And those, which is the mass and the majority of the Muslims, became more self-confident.
More self-confident.
Became more
assertive.
Spiritual, more religious.
Mm.
They were reawakened. Mm. So all this...
And they do carry the badge, if I can put it that way, the badge of... I remember this myself, the picture, of the small picture of the Imam that we used to wear in our younger days. We used to wear that with pride.
Exactly.
And that was not, that was
interesting,
that was a phenomenon that
it's
was
it's interesting
not there
you mentioned
before.
That, you know, during the Bosnian War. This is in the 90s.
Yes.
During the war in Bosnia.
Yes, I remember, yes.
You know, you had many of the Bosnian soldiers wearing Imam's picture.
Picture, yeah. And that said everything.
You know, they're Sunni.
Yeah.
Right.
But that said everything, didn't
you
it?
Know?
Yeah.
But for them, this was the image and the symbol of Islamic power.
Power.
Of dignity, of somebody who, you know, is a spiritually clean and pure person. You know, we talked about the way he lived himself.
Sure.
This is you see, Imam is the kind of person we want to be.
Be, exactly.
You know, we look at Imam and we're like, you know, this is the kind of person you want to be.
I think on that note, Dr. Mahdi Tarabi, I think that's something we should be thinking about day and night, actually, because, you know, even those of us who are past 40 should still think that there
those,
is room
those
for...
Those bad habits
yeah,
have
still
you know,
room for some reformation
those roots
there,
are
I
being
think so.
Getting
because,
thicker every day.
You know, because time is passing us, but at the same time, I do believe that what you say there in terms... Because Imam was a great model of emulation for us in the 20th and 21st century, still is, and will be for a long time to come. And, you know, we should get as much benefit and immerse ourselves in this man as much as we can, to get as much benefit as we can out of this while we still have time. But
inshallah.
Thanks very much, Dr. Mahdi Tarabi, for your contribution today. It's been really great. And it just leaves me to say, wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh. May the peace and mercy and blessings of Allah be upon you all. Thank you very much for listening today, and goodbye.